it's important that we cover, and we're going to have to go rather quickly through this material because we've only got about 35 minutes on my watch. So beginning with number 9.
Can I ask a question first before you proceed? It's got to do with what Chris asked also on the question of value.
Yeah.
Now, how would we, if it's my struggle, engage in a conversation with those who, proponents of those who say value is defined by what is my right. You know, this is my right and therefore I will do it. And that closes all further discussion because once you appeal to my right, what else is left to discuss?
Langer's notion of value is that value is what carries you to self-transcendence. And the scale of values is in terms of the degrees of self-transcendence to which you're carried by the different, you know, vital, social, cultural, personal, religious.
Mm-hmm.
But self-transcendence for him is the criterion of value. Okay, so just my right. No, my right, I've got rights. Okay, to claim my rights is not necessarily a non-self-transcendent action. It can be very self-transcendent and just action. Okay, the basis of a response to the question from this standpoint to that, I can't go any further without getting sidetracked. I don't think at the moment.
Okay.
Because I'm intent on what the responsibility that I have to create a course that other people can listen to as well. And so I've got to get through the material that's in chapter 18. Okay, we can discuss these things.
Could you say, just to respond with a question, could you say, do you have a right to be inattentive, unintelligent, rash, and irresponsible?
No, that's good. That is true. And that's his own paper, Natural Right. This is the basic right of every person, and it's also the right that everyone has to claim, and therefore they can also claim a right to a society that enables them to be attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. And I might add to a church that enables them to be attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. Okay. All right. Anyway, the structure of will and choice, there is something in these first notes about that structure give me just a moment here. Oh yeah, I think we do have to go back to number 6 for a minute, that there is an exigence for self-consistency. The structure that is being proposed in this chapter for ethics is a structure of self-consistency between knowing and doing. That's pretty much what I said earlier about the third form of election in St. Ignatius. The third form is calls for a consistency between knowing and doing. That's the structure that Lonergan's proposed. Now, if we can move to number 9, then. If the structure that explains the notions of will and choice is the structure of that my doing must be consistent with what I know, it remains that structure is an abstraction if people aren't free. What if I'm not free to do? How can we account for anything if we're not free? So section 2 in chapter 18 moves the possibility of ethics towards concreteness. We move in section 2 to establish that human beings are essentially free, and in number and then in the third section, that our effective freedom is more or less limited, and so we are in need of liberation. So there's a distinction then between essential freedom and effective freedom. Human beings are essentially free by the very structure of their consciousness, but the effective range of that essential freedom is limited. And it's more or less limited for each of us, and more or less limited in different domains for each of us. Essential freedom, first of all, then. Essential freedom is established in several steps. First of all, if there are coincidental manifolds in the universe so that no higher level is fully determined by the lower level, then one of the arguments that has been proposed against the possibility of freedom is ruled out. okay? If there isn't, if the universe is not clockwork mechanist determinism, where atoms, the movement of atoms, basically determines absolutely everything in the universe, if the canon of statistical residues is true, and there are coincidental manifolds at the chemical level, and then the biological level, and then the psychological level, and then the human level, so that not everything is determined from below upwards, then one of the arguments against freedom, that everything is just matter in motion, is ruled out. That doesn't prove freedom, it simply rules out one argument, if the worldview of emergent probability is an accurate worldview. That means that we're not, all of our actions are not determined simply by the movement of the atoms in our bodies and in our brains and around us and so on and so forth. Still, the positive account of freedom arises not from that, but rather from examining the act of will or the act of decision. If you don't like the word will here, if it reminds you too much of a scholastic faculty psychology, which Lonergan eventually moved away from, you can substitute decision. Examining the act of decision and its antecedents in knowledge, its cognitional antecedents. Only if these cognitional antecedents do not determine the act of will is the act free. And this was essentially the way Thomas, in his writings, Thomas Aquinas, approached the question of freedom. As it came up in our class last week when we were talking about chapter 19 and the very end of the class, is it true that if I know what I must do, I automatically do it? If that's the case, then my doing is not free, if knowledge determines my doing. So the first element then to be considered, again, look at it from the standpoint of experience, understanding, and judgment. The first element is the underlying sensitive flow. There are some human acts that occur through mere sensitive routine. There are acts that, you know, I mean, we just, you don't even stop to think about it. And sometimes we get into sensitive habits, like smoking, for instance, is a habit that for some people it occurs through mere sensitive routine. A lot of times they don't even make a choice. Today they're being forced to make more choices about something like that, but it occurs through mere sensitive routine. And only insofar as the possibility of imposing higher integrations upon lower coincidental manifolds, like certain desires, has been realized, does there arise the question of any free choice. So only insofar as there is the possibility of putting an order upon these impulses or whatever, does there arise the question of a free choice. He says later, people may not be, one may be essentially free but not effectively free to stop smoking. Okay. Next, there's the practical insight. So that's the experiential level. The practical insight, next. Understanding. Practical insight is an insight into what it would be good to do. It differs from a speculative insight, like a scientific insight, or a factual insight, like this is the situation, in that these insights, speculative or factual, are followed by the question, well, does this exist? Is this really the way it is? While the practical insight is followed by the question, is this going to exist? Are we going to bring this into existence? We're going to make the situation like this. So speculative and factual insights lead to knowledge of being, practical insights to the making of being. This is what it would be good to do. The objective of practical insights is not what is, but what is to be done. This means that the reflective understanding following upon a practical insight does not grasp a virtually unconditioned, at least in the sense of fact, but rather it grasps something else. What he'll say later is it grasps the value of doing something as virtually unconditioned. That eventually you reach the point where the questions are answered. So there's the practical insight. What are we going to do? And is somebody suggests an idea, and you know, the practical insight is that idea. This would be good to do. Next, there's the nature of practical reflection. After the practical insight, there's the question, well, is it really good? Examples are given on pages 633 and 634. We can raise questions about the object, about its alternatives, about its consequences, about motives for the course of action, you suggest something to me, and then we'd say, well, is this really the best thing to do? Why would we want to do this? We can examine our motives, the consequences. We can examine, well, does it fit into the given order? Is it going to upset too much? Should it upset some things? Maybe that's not always the worst thing in the world, to upset the given order. But if not, if it doesn't, why not? So corollaries to this point now about practical reflection, the reflection on. So somebody suggested a course of action, and that's the practical insight. When you reflect on it, you weigh it, you examine its consequences, what's it going to do to people, why are we doing this, what are our motives, so on and so forth. All of those questions we're actuating there, he says, rational self-consciousness. We're concerned with the reasons for our acts. We're concerned with ourselves as the persons that we will become if we follow this course of action. What's this going to do to me? What kind of person, what is this going to say about me if I act this way? Self-consciousness. I'm concerned with the reasons for my own acts as I scrutinize the potential course of action and investigate my motives. Secondly, practical reflection, this kind of reflection, it heads beyond knowing to doing, but still in itself, it still is knowing, but it's knowing heading towards doing. It's one thing to know exactly what could be done and all the reasons for doing it. It's quite another for that knowledge to issue in doing. This is what, of course, we had the questions about last week. As practical, rather than factual or speculative, this reflection has no internal term. Factual reflection upon factual insights, or reflection upon speculative insights, there's an internal term when we grasp the evidence to say, yes, this is the case. Then it brings it to conclusion. But practical reflection, its term is external to the knowing. Its term is the doing. So that even when you end the knowing by saying, this is what it would be good to do, I know this, this is the right course of action, there's still the question of whether or not one is going to do it. It has no capacity of its own to come to an end because the end is beyond the knowing. The knowing is in the judgment of value. But the end of it is the doing that follows from that. The judgment of value is a knowing that leads to doing. Its term is external to the knowing. The reflection is just knowing. The judgment is just knowing. The judgment of value is just knowing. But the term is an ulterior deciding and doing. So, and we all know this, that practical reflection can go on and on because we don't want to make the decision. And so it can, Kierkegaard himself spoke about infinite reflection. The reflection can expand more or less indefinitely. But we can also advert to that possibility and say, well, I don't want to just, you know, we don't want to be Hamlet. To be or not to be, that is the question. We know that we got to get on with the business of living. But even that is still just knowledge. It is one thing to know what I should do, and it is another to do it. Only decision will enforce the norm for the duration of the reflection. The normal duration of reflection is inverse to antecedent knowledge and willingness. If I know enough about the situation and I'm willing to do what's right, there's very little reflection involved once I know what's right. Once these are satisfied, only decision will end the reflection. Once I've decided, and as long as I remain decided, the reflection is over and done with. Now people can come back to me and say, are you sure you made the right decision there? And I could start it all over again. But the proposed course of action otherwise has ceased to be a mere possibility and it has begun to be an actuality. So that's the analysis that he's providing here of a kind of insight and a kind of reflection that while they are knowing, they head towards doing and they don't end really with the judgment of value. They end with the decision and the doing, which is something other than the judgment of value. Decision then is an act of willing. And just as knowing has the internal alternatives, Greg did graphics for two new CDs. Is it real? And you've got an alternative. You've got a path heading up this way and then going off like this. Yes, no. And what are judgments of value? And you've got another path and going down this way. Internal alternatives of either consenting or refusing. So it resembles judgment in that decision resembles judgment in that it selects one of a pair of contradictories. In judgment, it's yes, no. In decision, it's assent or refuse. It's concerned with actuality, though in a different way, and it's rational in that it deals with objects apprehended by insight, and it occurs because of reflective grasp of reasons. But decision's concern is to confer actuality, not to acknowledge actuality, not to acknowledge, to say this is real, but to confer reality on a course of action that does not yet exist. So, the rationality of decision differs radically from the rationality of judgment. And this is a quotation, I didn't put the page number down here. Judgment is an act of rational consciousness, but decision is an act of rational self-consciousness. Okay, what does that mean? The rationality of judgment emerges in the unfolding of the detached and disinterested desire to know, in the process towards knowledge of the universe of being. But the rationality of decision emerges in the demand of the rationally conscious subject for consistency between one's knowing and one's deciding and doing. Again, the rationality of judgment emerges if in fact a reasonable judgment occurs, but the rationality of decision emerges if in fact a reasonable decision occurs. Those are two different things again. Finally, the effective rationality of the subject of rational consciousness is radically negative. But the subject is effectively rational if one does not allow other desire to interfere with the functioning of the desire to know. But the effective rationality of the subject of rational self-consciousness is radically positive, because the subject is effectively rational only if one's demand for consistency between knowing and doing is followed by the positive act of deciding and doing in a manner consistent with one's knowing. So decision is a further enlargement of consciousness beyond knowing, where the already empirically intelligent and rationally conscious subject demands conformity of doing to knowing and accedes to that demand. Only in this enlargement, beyond judgment, does practical reflection come to an end. And this is the closest Lonergan comes in insight to implying a fourth level, to speak of an enlargement of consciousness. So the meaning then of obligation, moral obligation, emerges. Once I judge that I ought to act in a certain way, that I cannot be both reasonable and act otherwise, that my reasonableness is bound to the act by a link of necessity, in this sense, this is what I've got to do. But that doesn't mean I'm going to do it. It's necessity, but that necessity turns out to be contingent because of the change in context. This is what I've got to do, and I may know that, but there's still a contingency until I do it. In the context of rational consciousness, it's a necessity. In the context of rational self-consciousness, it can be called an exigence, but that doesn't mean it's going to be done. One cannot be a rational knower and deny the obligation, and one cannot be a rational doer and not fulfill the obligation. But one can be a rational knower, knowing the obligation, without an act of willing. And one cannot be a rational doer, doing it, without an act of willing. It is the addition of the further constitutive requirement of an act of will or an act of decision that marks the shift from rational consciousness to rational self-consciousness, that changes what is rational necessity in the field of knowing into rational exigence in the larger field of knowing and doing. So freedom, then, in Lonergan's analysis here, particularly, and also in Thomas's in the Summa Theologiae, is bound up with this contingence of the act of will vis-a-vis knowing. Freedom is a special kind of contingence. It arises not from the empirical residue that grounds the materiality and the non-systematic. So it's not like the contingence of particular places and particular times, for instance, but in the order of spirit, of intelligent grasp, reasonable reflection, morally guided will. It has the twofold basis that its object is merely a possibility, this course of action, doing this, and that its agent is contingent not only in existence but also in the extension of rational consciousness into rational self-consciousness. Just because I see that this is what I should do doesn't mean I'm going to do it. Freedom negatively excludes necessity but positively it imposes responsibility. Though the act of will is a contingent emergence, it also is an act of the subject. The measure of the freedom with which the act occurs also is the measure of one's responsibility for it. Well, that's section two on essential freedom. Now, we can pause here at this point and take some questions. I'm now confident that we're going to complete the material, which is something that I am intent on doing. Yes, Dorothy?
Okay. I'm interested in various flights from. So does the flight from decision correspond to flight from understanding, and is there also flight from judgment?
Yes, I think that my own view is that ultimately, in the existential order, so in the dramatic pattern of experience, the ultimate flight is the flight from decision. That's my own conviction. And if there's a flight from understanding in the dramatic pattern of experience, more often than not, it's a function of that what I'm really afraid of is that I'm going to have to make a decision. And so I just run away from the evidence. But I think that that's my own view. In so much in this book, he's so much concerned with establishing insight as having a very central role to play, not only in human knowing, but also in human living, that he's emphasizing the flight from understanding. But I think there's a flight from... the flight can come in at any level.
Yeah.
But I think in the dramatic pattern, it's ultimately a flight from what I've got to do to live an authentic life. And that has to do with decision.
I'm trying to create some connections here. Yeah. And basically, it's the connection between what psychologists call cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Because in a way, this is what... what's his name, was talking about last Thursday.
Sheldon,
when he said that, but if you know what is right, how can you not do it?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that what psychologists say is actually the opposite. You can know what is right, and you can not do it.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you don't do it, you will probably change your mind. And that would be the process of rationalization
to try
to justify
your
action.
That's right.
So is that then a creation of bias, which can then perpetuate in the system?
That's what this would set it up.
Okay.
At, yeah, very much so. Yeah. I should say in Sheldon's favor that you know he's got a lot of very good people on his side, including Plato. You know, I mean, Plato really saw freedom, knowing as that's it. You know, that knowledge is virtue. Or virtue is knowledge.
But only if it's authentic.
Hmm?
If it is, but only, I would say, if it is in the authentic person.
Yeah.
That is what the notion of wholeness is all about.
Yeah, and even there, what constitutes it is more than simply knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's impaired will involved in there, too. Like
that's
someone who smokes, they smoke, some might argue, you think smoking is good for you in some way, and that's why you're doing it. But in fact, they aren't free to make the decision not to smoke.
They aren't, no.
Right.
I know that.
Right?
Talk
about
it.
No, I'm not going there.
Can we come up with another example?
Drinking
well,
beer for breakfast.
Any,
I suppose that would kind of
any
exclude
addiction.
Yourself.
Any addiction is
any
addiction on freedom. Hans?
When I go through this process and I come to a decision, and then I have to make a decision, like I really consciously go through these various steps, and finally I now know and I make a decision. And yet there is out there another will who says, thou shalt. And I'm thinking in terms of morality, for instance. And that same voice says, you have to conform your will, your decision, to that will. Yet if I understand correctly, somewhere in Aquinas says that once you have, under all of the right circumstances, informed your conscience and you have made a decision, then morally obliged to follow that.
That's right.
In spite of the fact that there may be another will out there.
Oh, so you're talking about, for instance, dissent from
yeah.
teaching or something
yeah,
like
yeah.
that on the basis
yeah,
of
yeah.
conscience.
But it assumes that you go through all of the steps in freedom.
This would be one mode of going through steps to reach a decision.
Yeah.
There is also another mode that works with affectivity. And that mode, I think, can also come to a point of dissenting from what someone else might say is the right way.
So this is like informing your conscience.
Yeah. This is one way.
And I come to a decision, but out there is another will who says, "This is the will of."
Yeah, that's always going to happen. You know, it's always happened. We're speaking more about it these days than we have on other occasions. But it's always going to be the case that there will be people in positions of authority who will have a certain view on certain moral issues, and then other people come to other decisions with regard to that. It may be that their decisions are well informed and conscientious and responsible decisions.
I'm thinking potentially of Thomas More in his dialogue with his daughter, Margaret, on that. Like, once I'm going to be facing God, are you going to be there with me, Margaret? I have to make my decision.
There, of course, he was dealing with the state rather than the church. Okay, can we...
Can I just ask a final clarification question? In view of that cognitive dissonance thing, does it mean then that, in a way, us as being, whatever, as human beings, for us the action is more real even than our knowledge? Because in a way, if we're saying that it is our knowledge that will change to accommodate our action, then we give more priority to action. And what does that then have to say when it comes to cultural conversion?
Well, I mean, it's in our action that we most fully actuate ourselves. Definitely. And so, if we are, if there's a truncation of our action that causes a truncation in our knowing, which is what rationalization is. Bringing your knowing into conformity with your doing, and so on, then you're truncating your whole being. At that point, there is a truncation that takes place. But it's in our action that our fullest actuation as people takes place, not in our knowing, but in what we do, and especially in our loving. But our loving can be not just not just love in the sense of intimate acts and so on, but our loving can propel us to courses of action, justice, and so on, for the sake of the community. All right, so if we could, please, we can finish. I've got two number 20s here, which is a mistake, but anyway. The first number 20, talk about the measure of one's freedom, introduces the issue of the operational range of this essential freedom. We are effectively free in the measure that our dynamic structure is open. Openness, in the measure that it's open to grasping, motivating, and executing a broad or a narrow range of otherwise possible courses of action. And we ask ourselves, are we open to this, that, or the other possibility? Or sometimes people ask us, are you open to this or not? Our effective freedom may be limited. It may be limited by external circumstance. It may be limited by our psychoneural state. It may be limited by the limitations of our intellectual development. It may be limited by our antecedent willingness. My own view is that in insight, Lonergan was not yet sufficiently aware of the power of psychic interference as partly causing moral impotence. So he focuses mainly on intellectual and volitional, and that's okay as long as you don't. But I think I tried to make up for that in Chapter 8 of Theology and the Dialectics of History, where I emphasized that psychic difficulties can also be at the root of moral impotence. On 3 and 4, on the intellectual and volitional, this is what he has to say. The function of willingness runs parallel to to the function of the habitual accumulation of insights. What one does not understand yet, one can learn. But learning takes time. And until that time is devoted to learning, otherwise possible courses of action are excluded. Similarly, when antecedent willingness is lacking, when you're just saying, I'm not willing, don't even raise certain questions or issues, persuasion can be invoked, but persuasion takes time. And until that time is devoted to persuading oneself or to being persuaded by others, one remains closed to otherwise possible courses of action. I'm closed. Can't be done. Moreover, unless one's antecedent willingness has the height and breadth and depth of the unrestricted desire to know, the emergence of rational self-consciousness involves the addition of a restriction upon one's effective freedom. And how many people can claim that their antecedent willingness is that detachment, the detachment of the Ignatian exercises or of the Bhagavad Gita or of the depth of the unrestricted desire to know? They're all the same thing, universal willingness. Essential freedom is given, it's given, but effective freedom has to be won. The key point is to reach a willingness to persuade oneself and to submit to the persuasion of others. Because then one can be persuaded to a universal willingness. And then one becomes antecedently willing to learn all there is to be learned about willing and learning, and about the enlargement of one's freedom from external constraints and psychoneural interferences. But to reach the universal willingness that matches the unrestricted desire to know is indeed a high achievement. For it consists not in the mere recognition of an ideal norm, but in the adoption of an attitude towards the universe of being. Not in the adoption of an affective attitude that would desire but not perform, but in the adoption of an effective attitude in which performance matches aspiration. And the key question, and we've seen this leading up to this, the vicious circles, how is one to be persuaded to genuineness and openness when one is not yet open to persuasion? We are stuck at a certain point in this development from below upwards. The restrictions that arise on effective freedom from incomplete intellectual and volitional and affective development are what constitute our moral impotence. Our moral impotence is measured by the gap between the effective freedom we actually possess and the effective freedom we would possess if these conditions were fulfilled. It is not grasped with perfect clarity, but it's also not totally unconscious. And there's that lengthy quotation from page 650 suggesting that there are different levels or different degrees of freedom with regard to different areas in our lives. All right, I don't want to go on to too much more, but it's just that how the next point is how all of this is reflected in the social sphere, and then the final point, the essential problem, our incapacity for sustained development, a radical incapacity, a permanent incapacity, that unless there is some gift that comes to us, that meets us as we are and frees us from this, we are doomed to moral frustration. The solution has to be a higher integration of human living, not just in the mind, but in our lives, that takes people just as they are and works through their intelligence and reasonableness and freedom. And the question for the last two chapters is, does it exist? Has it emerged? Is there anything more? Or are we doomed to a moral frustration? The question of transcendent knowledge, and then the question of whether, if God exists, is God doing anything to help us in our plight? There we are. Thank you all for coming for this. It's 2:58, and I've got to be at the Academic Council at 3, so we can't stay around for too much. I'm very, very grateful that you were here so we could have another class. And I didn't have to do this in the abstract. Thank you very much.
Free class?
Oh. Actually, I read Prudence, Reading Aquinas, and Prudence is really up.